You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz, Collected Works, Volume 130. It is 23 lectures given between the 17th of September, 1911, and the 19th of December, 1912. And the lectures are either translated or revised by Matthew Barton. Lecture 1 is entitled The Christ Impulse and Historical Development, and it's given in Lugano on the 17th of September, 1911. We shall begin by discussing something of a general character, and since we are a small, intimate circle, we can then elaborate on any aspect that especially interests you. I would like to make some general statements about the being of man in connection with world being, with the macrocosm. And I will not approach it so much in the style of my book titled Theosophy. You can all gain what you need to from that. But I invite you to consider especially man's inner nature. If now and then we contemplate ourselves as human beings, we are immediately struck by the fact that we experience the world about us through our senses, and then think about the impressions we have received. We constantly observe these two attributes of man's being. If, for instance, we have put the light out at night and review the day's impressions before going to sleep, we are conscious that all day long the world has worked upon us. Now only the memory pictures of the day's impressions surge up and down in our souls. We know that we are thinking about them. Our soul now inhabits the after effects of what has taken place in us through outer impressions. Leaving more ordinary, trivial matters on one side, we see these memories of the day as individual to us. It is only because we are intelligent, individual human beings, beings with an intellect, that we are capable of receiving impressions of the world in this way. Now, in our spiritual life, this individual aspect is closely connected with external impressions. During the day, whilst we observe the world, our sense impressions and our thoughts intermingle. And at bedtime, when we no longer have any fresh sense impressions, but let those we have had pass through our soul, then we know very well that these are our pictures of what is outside. Our impressions of the outer world merge with what we are as individuals. They become one. Now, as we all know, one can make this inner individual element within us more and more alive, more and more exact, by the means already known to us and described, for instance, in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds. What you can experience, first of all, in your inner life, is that you feel you are not absolutely dependent in your thoughts on the external world. If, for instance, someone can think about what happened on Saturn, Sun, and Moon, then he has higher thoughts of this kind. For, of course, nobody can have external impressions of what happened on old Saturn, old Sun, and old Moon. We do not even need to go so far. If we ask ourselves in a quiet moment, quote, how many of my concepts have changed since my youth, close quote, this in itself is taking an independent, individual stand with regard to the world. When we form views about life, we feel ourselves becoming more independent in our intellect. Becoming independent in the individual element of the intellect is of great importance for human beings. For what does this mean? What does it mean for the human being to grasp general truths about life? Not just in theory, but through experience, even of things that are independent of external impressions. It means that he is becoming more independent in his etheric body. That is the first step in a long process. At the beginning, he does not even notice that he is freeing his etheric body a little. Ultimately, he can make it completely independent of the physical body. Whilst the beginning is just a tiny step toward becoming independent, the end is a total drawing out of the etheric body and a perceiving with it. We then have perceptions in the environment with this independent etheric body. We can even perceive in this way when we are not yet very advanced in inner mystical experience. We can grasp this, and to a certain extent understand it, if we remember what our perception is like in the physical body. With our physical body, we perceive by means of our senses, which are independent of each other. Our eyes function separately, and so do our ears. We can perceive the world of color and the world of sound separately. We can no longer do this when we perceive with our intelligence. In the case of intelligence, everything is a unity. Nothing is divided into separate spheres. Likewise, we cannot perceive with etheric eyes and etheric ears as though they were separate sense realms, but we perceive the etheric world in general. And when we begin to say something about it, we can describe how etheric experience works as a comprehensive whole. I will not discuss how much further this experience can lead, but only point out that when we perceive how our intelligence forms general truths, then we can perceive something of the etheric elements. Whoever perceives the etheric world and can gradually realize that a higher world of this kind exists, can have an inner conviction that an etheric body is the basis of the physical body. As soon as we speak of such a thing as the etheric body, we must take our lead from important things we can learn through direct experience. As soon as we know that the physical body is interpenetrated by an etheric body, we will readily understand the occultist describing how paralysis is an abnormal occurrence of what otherwise happens through normal training. It can happen that a person's etheric body withdraws from his physical body. Then the physical body becomes independent. Paralysis could possibly result, for the physical body has been deprived of its enlivening etheric body. But we do not need to go as far as the appearance of paralysis, for we can understand its appearance in everyday life even better. For example, what is a lazy person? He is someone who has a weak etheric body from birth, or who has let it grow weak through neglect. We try to correct it by relieving the physical body of its leaden heaviness, and by some means making it lighter. A thorough cure, however, can only arise by way of the astral body, for this can stimulate the etheric body to fresh life. But you have to realize something else. The etheric body is actually the bearer of our whole intellect. When we go to sleep at night, all our thought pictures and memories actually remain in the etheric body. The human being leaves his thoughts behind in the etheric body and does not return to them until morning. By laying aside the etheric body, we lay aside the whole web of our experiences. The nature of this etheric body, however, is such that when we investigate it in a spiritual, scientific way, we can quite clearly perceive that we are subject to a far greater number of changes in the course of time than we would imagine. We all know, of course, that man has passed through a series of incarnations. It is not for nothing that we are incarnated again and again. Man's vision is limited. It is a general belief that our organization has always been as it is today. In fact, the human organization changes from one century to another, only we cannot perceive this externally. In the frontal lobe of the brain, there is an organ with delicate convolutions that has only developed since the 14th to 15th centuries. It is an organic form for the purely intellectual life of present centuries. We can well imagine that it is impossible for a detail of this kind to alter in the brain without, in fact, the whole human organization altering, even if only slightly. So that the human organization does indeed show signs of changes as the centuries pass by. But it is only through reading the Akashic Record that these changes can be confirmed, which is where changes in the etheric body can be best observed. We see that the people of ancient Greece or ancient Egypt had etheric bodies that were quite different. All the etheric streams in them were different. Now, in order to arrive at a thought that can be useful and productive for us, I would like to make a short digression and draw your attention to the fact that even in ordinary life you can assume the existence of more than one world. The human being goes to sleep without knowing that he is passing into another world. But the fact that he is asleep and does not know anything about it does not prove that this other world does not exist. Other worlds do impinge in a certain way. The human being perceives with his senses when he is in the physical world, but not when he withdraws into himself. Then he has a thought world which borders on the physical, and he finds within himself, in addition to the already developed element of intellect, two other elements as well, that are quite different again. Can the human being develop these other elements? A simple reflection can show that something else is more characteristic of our inner life than merely having thoughts. This is present whenever we feel ourselves to be moral human beings. That is the world where we connect a feeling of sympathy or antipathy with certain definite experiences. This goes beyond intellectual experience. Someone shows goodwill to another and we are pleased, or he shows ill will and we are displeased. That is something quite different from what is experienced purely intellectually. Mere reflection does not produce in us the feeling of whether a deed is moral or not. A person can be highly intelligent in an intellectual way without feeling the repulsive nature of a purely egotistical action. That is another realm of experience, which we also become aware of when we admire what is beautiful and elevating in works of art, or are repulsed by what is ugly. What elevates us in works of art cannot be grasped by the intellect, but only by our life of soul. So we can say, something comes into our life in this way which is beyond the intellect. If an occultist observes a soul at the moment when it is experiencing aversion from an immoral deed or pleasure in a moral one, he perceives a higher level of soul life. The mere having of thoughts is on a lower level of soul life than pleasure in or aversion from moral or immoral deeds. If a human being strengthens his etheric body and so develops a more intense feeling for what is moral or immoral, this can be seen not only as increased strength in his etheric body, but as an increase of strength in his astral body too, and a special intensification of the astral forces. So that we can say, a person who has particularly sensitive feelings about moral and immoral deeds will acquire especially strong forces in his astral body, whilst a person who only improves his etheric body intellectually with exercises, say, that strengthen the memory, can certainly develop his clairvoyance a great deal, but he will not get beyond the etheric astral world, because the intellectual element alone is active within him. If we want to get beyond the astral world, we must do the kinds of exercise in which we develop sympathy for moral deeds and antipathy for immoral deeds. Then we do indeed ascend to a world that is behind our world in more than just an astral sense. We then ascend to the heavenly world, so that we can say, in the great invisible world, the heavenly world of the macrocosm corresponds to our response to moral or immoral impressions, and the astral world of the macrocosm corresponds to our intellectual sense perception of the physical world. All that develops within the intellectual element corresponds to the astral world, whilst what can be developed in relation to moral or immoral deeds corresponds to the heavenly world, the world of Devakan. Then there is yet another element in the human soul. There is a difference between feeling happy about moral deeds and feeling responsible enough to carry out what thus appeals to you and to withstand doing what is not moral. A feeling of responsibility for our actions is the highest level we can reach in the world today. So the human being's soul stages can be set out like this. Number one, the sense person. Number two, the intellectual person, who relates to the first invisible world. Number three, the aesthetic person with moral feelings, who is attracted or repelled by moral and immoral deeds. This corresponds externally to the lower devakanic world. And number four, the morally active person. Actually carrying out what we feel within ourselves to be the highest moral ideals corresponds externally to the higher devakanic world, the world of reason, ruled by those beings who represent absolute reason in the world. When the human being can grasp that his moral impulses give a shadow picture of the highest world from which he comes, he has understood a great deal about the macrocosm. So, we have the physical world and the world of the intellect, the moral world, or the heavenly world of lower Devakan, and the world of reason, or higher Devakan. Cosmic worlds cast in us shadow pictures of the sense world, the intellectual world, intellectual clairvoyance, the aesthetic world, moral feeling, the world of reason, moral impulses for deeds. Through a kind of self-knowledge, man can perceive these different stages within himself. Now, this whole configuration of the human being has altered in the course of time. In ancient Greek or Egyptian times, the human being was not at all as he is today. In the Greek age, man was so constituted that higher beings ruled over the soul element within him, and so he felt a kind of natural obligation toward those beings. We now live in the age when man is ruled by his intellect, and so he feels something like an aesthetic moral obligation. In those olden times, however, it would have been impossible for anyone to have conceived of acting in a way contrary to a moral impulse that presented itself. In Greece, they still felt pleasure and displeasure so strongly that they had to act accordingly. Then came the modern age, when people do not even feel an obligation toward the aesthetic element, as one can see from the saying, quote, "There's no accounting for tastes," close quote, though people who have a developed taste can probably agree among themselves. What was felt in earlier times to be a necessity in the moral and aesthetic sphere is nowadays felt to be so in the intellectual sphere, to have a certain standard in thinking, not thinking as you like, but conforming to the laws of logic. This brings us, however, to the lowest point of human experience. At the moment, we are at a transitional stage, as we can well see. For if we look at past millennia, we see the physical body of man drying up more and more, until he has become quite different. 1.5 millennia ago, the physical body was considerably softer and more pliable. It has become harder and harder. On the other hand, something quite different has occurred in the etheric body. Something that the human being could have less experience of because this etheric body has passed through an upward development. It is significant that we stand at the important moment when the human being must grow aware that his etheric body should become different. That is the event that will take place in this 20th century. Whilst, on the one hand, an intensification of the intellectual element is making itself felt, on the other hand, the etheric body will become so much more independent that human beings are bound to become aware of it. For a period of time after the Christ event, people did not think as intellectually as they do today. Strengthening the intellectual element causes the etheric body to become more and more independent, so that it can also be used as an independent instrument. And during this process, it can be seen to have gone through a hidden development which makes possible the perception of the Christ in the etheric body. Just as the Christ could formerly be seen physically, he can now be seen etherically, so that in this 20th century a beholding of the Christ will occur like a natural event, in the way Paul saw him. A number of people will be able to see Christ in the etheric, which means that we shall know him even if all Bibles are destroyed. We shall not need any records then, for we shall see him. And that is an event equal in importance to what occurred on Golgotha. In the centuries to come, a greater and greater number of people will reach the stage where they can see the Christ. The next 3 millennia on earth will be devoted to the kind of development whereby the etheric body becomes more and more sensitive, so that certain people will experience this and other events. I will just mention one more thing to come. There will be more and more people who want to do something and then have an urge to hold back. Then a vision will follow, and these people will perceive increasingly clearly that what happens in the future is the karmic result of what they had previously done. A few people who are ahead of the rest already feel such things. It happens especially with children. There is a tremendous difference between what trained clairvoyants experience and what I have described here as something that will come about in the natural course of events. Since time immemorial, the trained clairvoyant experienced the Christ by means of certain exercises. On the physical plane, if I meet someone, he is there in front of me with clairvoyant vision. On the other hand, I can perceive him in quite different places, and we do not actually meet. It has always been possible to see the Christ clairvoyantly, but to meet him, now that he stands in a different relationship to humanity, helping us from the etheric world, is something which is independent of our clairvoyant development. From the 20th century onward, in the next 3,000 years, certain people will be able to meet him objectively as an etheric form. That is very different from experiencing a vision of him through inner development. This places the exalted being we call the Christ in an altogether different sequence of evolution from that of the Buddha. The Bodhisattva who became Buddha was born into the royal house of Suddhodana and became Buddha in the 29th year of his life, so that he did not need to undergo further incarnations. When such a being, a bodhisattva, becomes a Buddha or master, this signifies a higher form of inner development that any human being can pass through. The esoteric training of a human being is a start in the direction that can lead to Buddhahood. That has nothing to do with what happens around us. Such people appear at certain times to help the world forward. But those events are different from the Christ event. Christ did not develop out of another human individuality. He came from the macrocosm, whilst all the bodhisattvas have always been connected with the earth. So we have to be clear that insofar as we speak about bodhisattvas or Buddhas, we do not come near to the Christ. For Christ is a macrocosmic being who became connected with the earth for the first time through the baptism by John. That was his physical manifestation. Now, the etheric manifestation is coming. Then will come the astral one, and a higher one still after that. Human beings will first have to be far advanced before they experience that higher stage. What human beings can experience belongs to the general laws of the earth. The being whom we call by the name of Christ, or by other names, will also bring about what we can describe as the saving of all souls on earth for Jupiter existence, whilst everything else will fall away with the earth. Anthroposophy is not something arbitrary, but something of importance that had to come into the world. The world must learn to understand the Christ being, who lived for 3 years on the earth at the beginning of our present era. In my book titled The Spiritual Guidance of Man and Humanity, you will find details about the two Jesus boys. The Christ event was prepared for by an individuality connected with the sect of the Essenes, Jeshu ben Pandira, who was born 100 years before the two Jesus boys were born in Palestine. So you have to distinguish between them and Jeshu ben Pandira, of whom Haeckel, among others, has spoken in a most derogatory way. The Matthew Gospel, in the main, originated from this most exalted person, Jeshu ben Pandira, as a preparation for what was to come. In what way should we understand the relationship of Jeshu ben Pandira to Jesus of Nazareth? The individualities have nothing to do with one another initially, except that one prepared the way for the other. As individualities, they are in no way related. The facts are that in one of the Jesus boys, the one described in the Luke Gospel, we have a somewhat indefinable individuality, so far difficult to understand in that he could speak immediately after birth in a way his mother could not understand. He was not intellectual, this individuality of the Luke Gospel, but tremendously vital and elemental in the realm of moral feelings. The astral body of this being was influenced by the individuality of the Buddha. When he had reached the Buddha stage, Buddha did not need to incarnate on earth any further. As long as he was a bodhisattva, he continued to incarnate. After he had become Buddha, he was active from the higher worlds, and his activity flowed through the astral body of the Jesus of the Luke Gospel. The forces emanating from Buddha are in the astral body of this Jesus boy. Thus the Buddha stream is contained within the Jesus of Nazareth stream. On the other hand, what is told in Eastern writings, and is also known to be correct by Western occultists, is that at the moment the bodhisattva becomes Buddha, a new bodhisattva appears. In the moment when Gautama Buddha became Buddha, this bodhisattva individuality was taken from the earth, and a new bodhisattva became active. He is the bodhisattva who is to become a Buddha in due time. In fact, the time is exactly determined when the successor of Gautama Buddha, Maitreya, will become a Buddha. 5,000 years after the enlightenment of Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree, roughly 3,000 years after our time, the world will experience the Maitreya Buddha incarnation, which will be the last incarnation of Jeshu ben Pandira. This bodhisattva, who will come as Maitreya Buddha, will also come in a physical body in our century, in his reincarnation in the flesh, but not as Buddha. And he will make it his task to give humanity true concepts about the Christ event. Genuine occultists recognize the incarnations of the bodhisattva, the Maitreya Buddha to be. In the same way as other human beings, this individuality will also go through a development of the etheric body. When humanity becomes more like him who is to become the Maitreya Buddha, then this individuality will go through a special development that, in a certain respect, in its highest stages, will be something like the baptism of Jesus of Nazareth. He will undergo an exchange of individuality. In both cases, another individuality comes in. They grow up as children in the world, and after a certain number of years, their individuality is exchanged. It is not a continuous development, but a development that undergoes a break, as was the case with Jesus. In his case, there was an exchange of individuality of this kind in the 12th year, and then again at the baptism by John. This kind of exchange occurs, too, with the Bodhisattva, who is to become the Maitreya Buddha. These individualities are suddenly, as it were, fructified by another. The Maitreya Buddha in particular will live with a certain individuality until his 30th year, and then an exchange will occur in him, as we find with Jesus of Nazareth during the baptism in Jordan. We will always recognize the Maitreya Buddha, however, from the fact that nothing will be known of him prior to this exchange of individuality, even though he is present, and then he will suddenly reveal himself. Leading an unknown life is characteristic of all bodhisattvas who are to become Buddhas. The human individuality in the future will have to be more and more self-reliant. It will be a characteristic of his that he will pass unknown in the world for many years, and it will only be possible to recognize him then through the fact that he works from out of his own inner strength as a self-reliant individual. It has been known for thousands of years past, and is now recognized by occultists of the present day, that the nature of his being needs to remain unknown throughout his youth, until the time of the birth of the intellectual soul, indeed, even until the birth of the consciousness soul, and that he will come into his own with the help of nobody but himself. Any true occultist would find it strange for a Buddha to appear in the 20th century, as every occultist knows that he can only come 5,000 years after Gautama Buddha. However, a bodhisattva can and will be incarnated. It is part of an occultist's basic armory to know that the Maitreya Buddha will be unknown in his youth. That is why I have been emphasizing for years that we should bear this principle of occultism in mind. Before a certain age, nobody should be obliged by any central office or organization to speak about occult matters. I have stressed this for years. When younger people speak, they may do this for good reasons, but they do not do it as an occult duty. The Maitreya Buddha will make himself known through his own power. He will appear in such a way that he can receive no help except from the power of his own soul being. To approach true theosophy, understanding for the whole of earth evolution, is a necessity. Those who do not develop this understanding will destroy the life of the modern theosophical movement. The end of Lecture 1.